I've always been in doubt about everything. I mean, even though I've been courageous and made a lot of super risky entrepreneurial moves, I was always in doubt. I just felt that if I lose this one, at least I took a chance for a good reason.
Welcome and welcome back, Mario. Now we go to the Nordics. We have been to Copenhagen in Denmark several times. If you think back about this beautiful city and the restaurants, what comes up into your mind?
I think I always have been jealous of the Danish, because I come from a small country by ourselves, Austria, and I think we always have been jealous about the Nordic movement, which our guests started, because it's incredible what Noma started there and what all the Noma kids and grandkids did. I mean, we have been to Geranium last year, Florian, we have been to Geist, all of these restaurants in the spirit of Noma. And I still remember the first time I went to Noma, which was really eye-opening, different cuisine. So I have the most positive memories to Copenhagen. And after the great dinners, the next morning, I always loved the bread. You know that I love the bread. So the good bread in the morning after the fine dining was always the secret hero of the drink.
That's true. Danish bakery. Klaus Meyer is on our show, and I will make I wanted to try to make a short introduction, but he has so many achievements that this introduction will turn out a little bigger. So Klaus Meyer is a very prominent Danish restaurateur, chef, and culinary entrepreneur who has played a significant role in shaping contemporary Nordic cuisine. He's perhaps best known, and we heard that already from Mario, as one of the co-founders of Noma, together with Chef René Recipe, the world-renowned Copenhagen restaurant that has been awarded multiple Michelin stars and has been named the world's best restaurants 5 times. He developed an early interest in food and gastronomy, but initially Klaus pursued academic studies in economics and business administration and earned a master's degree in that. He co-authored the New Nordic Food Manifesto in 2004. He founded Meyer's Mad, who's a culinary school and food company that provides catering services, runs bakeries, and produces high-quality food. Projects including establishing culinary schools and programs to combat poverty and unemployment. His last venture was in 2016 when he actually moved to New York and opened a food hall, the Great Northern Food Hall, and a high-end restaurant in the New York City's Grand Central Terminal. So Klaus Meyer's influence extends far beyond his restaurants. His entrepreneurial ventures continues to blend gastronomy with social responsibility. And we are so happy to have Klaus on our show today and learn from this incredible journey. So welcome, Klaus. That was a little introduction. So Klaus, let's directly dive in. What inspired your passion for food and hospitality, especially when we know now that you are coming from a background of economics?
What inspired me was 1 year spent in France when I was 19 years old. Half of that year, I landed in a very particular family in Gascony, the capital of Gascony called Agen, which is the capital of prunes globally. And what was very special was that the family that I ended up spending 6 months with, more or less, consisted of Guy's Versuit, who was so-called meilleur ouvrier de France. He was one of the best craftsmen of his generation within both pastry and cooking. And also him and his wife could not have children, and they had always wanted to have a son. Mm. In my end, I came down to Gascony because I had got hepatitis during my au pair job in Paris. And I was allowed to go on a recreational stay. And coming from a family in Denmark, where I grew up with my father and mother until they divorced when I was 14 years old, they were way too young to have a child. They were not very responsible, and food was shitty. So coming to this family in Gascony, where food was so amazing, even on a Monday night, and also feeling their empathy, if not love, I mean, from strangers, that gave me some very strange ideas about the correlation between love and deliciousness. And I somehow came back to Denmark with something that felt like a calling, that the incredible revelation that I had gone in France, and somehow had to share that with other people in Denmark. So that kind of became my mission, to be a change maker, trying to bring out the very best in all kind of food culture.
Okay, and you actually succeeded, because Noma became at the end the world's best restaurant, awarded 5 times, plenty Michelin stars.
Every end goals, you know, it's fine dining or winning some accolades was obviously not the end goal. For me, was for everyone, ideally in our country, to have access to the everyday life happiness, the joy, the gratitude, the small competence that allow you to become someone who actually cooks a meal for your wife or your children or your friends. So for me, for me, Noma was almost an instrument. For me, the end goal was a progress of people coming together around tables, celebrating nature, the terroir, their own territory. It doesn't mean that I'm not proud of Noma or the achievements of the Nordic cuisine movement, but I also just am very much aware that that was only the beginning.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's very important what you're saying, especially in these days where people, or you have the feeling that societies here and there actually falls apart, and how important hospitality and food at the end as a staple is to be the glue amongst human beings, right?
And yes, that on the one hand, and also just the fact that, I mean, these days, I think that 7 out of 10, seven out of 10 deaths globally have to do with non-communicable diseases. So we belong to a civilization where we have forgotten how to eat.
Yeah.
And also, we are at the point of burning down all the planet, and we have dropped at the point where, I mean, the safe space, operating safe space for how we live as humanity. But the interesting thing for us who are involved in cooking and hospitality is that some our food culture and the way we produce the food that we eat, holds the key to address another very important crisis. Mm-hmm. So I think if we can get our systems and our food culture right, then we can probably alleviate the problems that are attached to biodiversity, climate change, mental health, physical health.
I think, Klaus, that you touched on this sustainability. I mean, you started talking about sustainability when it was uncool to talk about sustainability, like before the new movement, because when you made the new Nordic food manifesto, it was revolutionary back then. And now it's easy to look back and say this was changing. But I expect back then people were not waiting for that and standing and applauding that we have been waiting for that. So how was this initial reaction on this manifesto? Did you feel you had enough support even from the colleagues in your industry? Did you create, because it sounds like so big, because it manifesto sounds like a movement, but we know that you started it with a handful of people. How was this early days? And maybe in the same question, Klaus, the sustainability aspect, because you said not very strong that by eating right and eating the right thing, we also can solve the sustainability issue of our planet. But back then, how was the reaction on that?
I think it's not a coincidence that that this movement took ground in Scandinavia, where I believe it's fair to say that we have been for at least a couple of decades a region with pretty sophisticated ideas about corporate social responsibility, the importance of the UN Development Goals, and organic production of produce, and even about the ratio between how we eat and health. So I think that deliciousness was, for strange reasons, something that was not very pronounced, neither in the restaurant food nor in people's everyday home cooking. But I do think that we launched this project in fertile ground, so it didn't come of too much of a revolution, and that was also important. But also we framed it in the Nordic Cuisine Manifesto in a very inclusive way. So this was not about everyone changing everything before tomorrow. So it was very important to create or to share a vision that ended up being bold enough. We know that today. But that was raised in such a way that even the big players within agriculture and food industry could connect to it and see themselves as one contributing to the change. We wanted basically the manifesto to be rooted in Parliament, because we found that it was very problematic if a change of government overnight would wipe away governmental support to the necessary transformation of our food culture. So we were kind of pretty tactical about it. And honestly, I think people loved the idea of combining the search for deliciousness with a responsibility for how food impacts, you know, and the planetary boundaries.
Mm. And Klaus, if you now look back what this manifesto and this movement has achieved over the last years, is that something back then you could picture? Are you surprised or disappointed what the manifesto created?
I mean, I am obviously one of them changed. I mean, particularly the restaurant scene, but also the level of consciousness about the power of cooking and hospitality, and how you can impact very important issues in society way beyond the dinner table.
No.
Of course, I'm still stunned by the impact it had. Also, because we had no mandate, and we had no budget, we had no resources. About open source, trusting everyone's capability to co-create the change that was needed. But that being said, I'm also painfully aware that in terms of truly addressing the real crisis that our civilization is facing, it's not enough that we have that Noma has been voted best restaurant 5 times, or that the Nordic region now has been awarded 105 Michelin stars. It's a very different ball game to take. For these values to transition from a very privileged community of foodies and top restaurateurs, and then for these ideas and beliefs that should take hold in ordinary people's lives, which is what what is needed, not only for the world, but also I think there's a lot of in this whole mental illness thing that our young generation are face. Obviously, it's also about the internet and Instagram. But I think that when our lives become detached from cooking and we don't share meals with each other, I think that we are exposed to a severe risk of a loss of meaning and purpose and togetherness that I think is much more of a problem that we may think.
Yeah, I agree. And I always use in a lot of my speeches a quote from Albert Einstein, who said, in life only two things matter, love and food. And I think this combination of love by sharing bread and the indulgency of food and the togetherness is something which will probably in cause of the mental health. I want to touch one thing, which is like early crisis or doubt. If we go back to this Nordic movements or the start of Noma or the way to the fine dining temple or heaven or whatever you want to call it, on that initial years after you coming back from France, after starting the Nordic movement, after starting Noma, can you recall any early struggles, doubts, roadblocks in that phase in your early career as an entrepreneur?
I have always been in doubt about everything. Even though I've been courageous and made a lot of super risky entrepreneurial moves, I was always in doubt. I just felt that if I lose this one, and I don't know if I probably win, but if I lose this one, at least I took a chance for a good reason, because if I would succeed, then it would benefit more things than my own wallet. That was my rule of thumb. So I've always been in doubt. The first two major roadblocks, I believe, was in 2006 or 2007, 3 years after the birth of Noma and a couple of years after the emergence of the Nordic cuisine movement, my company at that point in time, we have 400 employees, and we had a 60 million euro revenue per year, and we didn't earn money at all, and the society in the entirety of Europe was facing an economic crisis. Everyone knew about that, and I was the CEO, as well as obviously the Minister of Fantasy and Brand Guardian and what have you. But I was also the founder of the company, so at any given time I could fire the entire board. But the thing that happened was that the board, they actually fired me from the CEO position. It's too scary with you being the CEO. So with a little bit of a smile, they said, you need to go, Klaus. You cannot be the brand ambassador, responsible for all kinds of new endeavors, communication, quality control, and then also be this. And you don't have the CEO in your blood. You're not a typical CEO. So time has come for you to step down. And then they introduced another individual who was the antithesis of myself, had no cooking, didn't eat vegetable or fish, he only eats meat. So in many ways, a very special individual. But he was an accountant, and also he was trained in leadership from a very young age, at the age of 20, he took over a big supermarket in Jutland and was trained to understand how to care about costs and how to appeal to an ordinary guy in the street, which is something that I never cared about. So he was an incredible asset to the company, and the next 5 years became tremendous from a financial perspective and from a culinary perspective. I was already on a good strike.
And you mentioned a second thing. What was the second? The second doubt you had.
Always doubted. I mean, I'm somebody. I mean, you meet people that say they always have the right answer to any question, and they're always right about everything. I'm the opposite. When I'm arguing about over something with someone, I always understand the other person's point. I have no problem connecting with why the other one is right and why I'm wrong. So doubt will be, it's a fuel, definitely, but it's also a curse.
Because it's
cumbersome. It's stressful. And you always question your own decision.
Mm-hmm. Florian, before you come to your question, I have one follow-up question, Klaus. Your ego, I mean, everybody of the entrepreneurs has an ego. We can argue now if yours is bigger or smaller than others, but it must be definitely a slap in the face when your board hired this anti-Klaus, so to say, who was the opposite of you. How did your ego handle that?
Because of the way I was brought up and my father's inclination to always point at my deficiencies and imperfections, I never had a hard time connecting with my old weaknesses. So I like to be appreciated by other people, and I like to feel that I'm loved by the universe, because I don't take the love of the ones close to me for granted. But I've never had a problem with people pointing at something that I'm not capable of doing. So of course, in certain ways, in certain ways, I might have a big ego, but not in the classical way. I'm not a big dick guy, you know? So for me, it was cool. I saw it more as a relief.
We had here then,
and I was very happy that they made the decision, and they don't ask me to make it. They made the decision for me, and they put somebody in place who I capable of understanding such a very complex company that he arrived in, now that he didn't know how to cook or appreciate food. And I was all over the place, orchards, bakeries, cooking school, that restaurant, Michelin restaurants. It is, but surprisingly, he had no problem. For me, but more than anything, it was a massive relief that I could focus on what I was most fond of doing, and also what I was best at doing. So my self-confidence was strengthened, because I, you know, waking up in the morning, I would face a number of successes because I was no longer doing things I didn't know how to do.
We learned already, Klaus, that social responsibility plays a big role in your entire life and how you actually do business. Tell us a little bit about it. What drives your commitment in social change through food?
I think because of my relationship to my parents that didn't have the maturity or the capacity to combine that with the life that I encountered in France. For me, everything I've done has somehow been about benefiting something outside of my own reality. Not that I didn't have a company that was profitable, but being a benign someone that would meet gratitude and a spirit of collaboration and friendship in my business life, for the good or for the bad, that has always been. So for me, I have three daughters, and it's very important for me that they're proud of their father. I want to be a different. I want them to be proud of my achievement. So I've always been at the lookout for bold, generous, sensational things to embark on.
So share a success story out of your initiative.
So at the more concrete reason for the establishment of this foundation was, on the one hand, we suddenly under the leadership of this man that I told you about before, we started earning a hell of money. Secondly, my mentor, during the process of writing up the Nordic Cuisine Manifesto, he called me up in 2012 and said that he had read the manifesto again, and he had come to the conclusion that we got it wrong. Not the wording, but scope. So he basically told me that night on the phone that we could leave out the word Nordic. I asked him if he was wrong, because I couldn't understand what he was saying, alluding to. But then his point was that we had come up with something more universal, namely a narrative or an approach that could enable potentially any developing country or any culture with a very clear role or position in the hierarchy of world cuisines to stand up against McDonaldization and the dominance of French and Spanish and Italian gastronomy. And I thought that was a beautiful idea. So I put through and set aside 1 million euros and lost the fund. The purpose of which was to leverage everything I learned from starting MoMA, the Nordic Cuisine Movement, and also my network to bring hope.
Yeah.
The first, we did a very interesting project in a partnership with the Danish Prison Service. We established a full school in a closed state that educated around 150 inmates to become chefs. And it was tremendously successful. But probably the most interesting endeavor that we embarked on was a project in Bolivia where we tried to mimic the Nordic cuisine approach. So we started a restaurant, the capital of La Paz, or the capital of Bolivia, which is named La Paz. And also gathered a number of the most thought leaders, philosophers, farmers, fishermen, journalists, and chefs in Bolivia, and catalyzed a process. They ended up writing the Bolivian Cuisine Manifesto, and we did a festival, and we started the slum school for the very poor kids. And a few years later, Bolivian gastronomy was on fire.
Yeah,
and now we have sent money to Bolivia for the last 10 years. Gusto is the restaurant that we started working 100% local ingredients. Is now 30 this year. This with 50 beds in Latin America. Another, I think, 4 or 5 Bolivian restaurants are on top 100, mm-hmm. all of which either owned or led by Gusto alumni.
Yes. Yeah.
With a total investment of 5 million euros, I do think that we have made a hell of an impact.
Absolutely.
I think there's a lot of respect around the project, but it was never about, we never fell into the trap of white savior narrative. Comes a white euro that will save
our
own shit. We succeeded in phrase it correctly and come across as a humble, friendly catalyst of change.
I think the interesting part in that story, especially in Bolivia, is you create successful businesses because you know how to create a successful business with a good idea and a social responsibility. But even though, and this is a question that goes again into the direction of doubt, I can imagine that if you want to do good, and you invest money, you invest your own positive energy into something like that, helping people in a underdeveloped area, for example, there must be roadblocks within society, political, etc., where you think, I'm here to help, why don't you let me help? Isn't that more frustrating than at the end, creating a good, sustainable business?
I felt a lot. I really felt reiterated during the entire process, even though I'm always the one bringing money and knowledge to me. And I never took anything of that back. But they but the currency of the Bolivian people was love. Mm-hmm. So that's what they paid me, you know, sufficiently with gratitude and love. I don't think that in any sense that we met the resistance from the people we trained or from collaborators of the projects. It took a little bit of time before Bolivian upper class and middle class, and together with expats in La Paz, were the sole customers that could sustain the restaurants. So it took a little bit of while to understand the point of eating alligator from the Amazon and you know, fish they hadn't been eating for maybe a century or, I mean, decades at least. So this new cuisine, it took a little bit of time to take hold and for them to trust it. But it was more technical problems we ran into. I mean, lack of revenue, one thing. We always, we had a couple of business people wanted to cheat us. And we got cheated a couple of times. There was a very, very positive atmosphere around it because we got the narrative right from the beginning. I mean, we come with money. We don't ask for anything, not even recognition. We just want to give, and we do it in a kind, healthful, respectful way. So not that it was easy to navigate and to understand how to make this. Now it's sustainable. To make it economically sustainable was super complicated because every second year there is some kind of crisis or the losing president want to take over the country again, even though he was not voted for. And I mean, there are all kinds of social uproars and all kinds of strange crises. So he said, it's a fragile third world country. And also it's a corrupt country. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's under number 178, the position in the rank of the most transparent countries in which to do business, Bolivia is 178.
Yeah, because the question is who is behind Bolivia. But at the end of the day, hearing you talking, I mean, your friend was right. You got it wrong at the beginning. It is not the Nordic Manifesto. You proved by yourself. I mean, probably there's not a lot of countries which are so different than Bolivia and Denmark was. You always said that the only difference was that the food was bad when you started. But in terms of everything else, it was really proven to help to support. Is there any country after proving it in Denmark and Bolivia where you say, okay, this is, I'm up for one more?
But we actually did start a culinary school called the Brownsville Community Culinary Center in East New York, 11 kilometers from Manhattan, and against all odds, because my more traditional businesses during Corona, but you know, for strange reasons, the intrepid endeavor ended up surviving, and now 10 years down the road is being taken over by local people from this African-American community. And then also in Africa, 2 years ago, we started Umami, which is an initiative comparable to Wolfstool and Medicine for Bolivia. It's in Marrakech, Morocco. And the big idea is to see if we can help train and graduate thousands of young Moroccans and share what we do down the road with them. But it also help restore Morocco as the grand culinary destination it once was back in the year 785 after Jesus Christ. I think that our initiative is super scalable, and we really because we become almost like a viral, and people just want to help. you know, chefs coming in from Europe to connect with the youngsters. And to run a small food school in a poor country is not, of course, project management and bringing the right teachers down, etc. It costs a little bit of money, but in the big scheme of things, if you can truly help transform the food culture of a developing country, there's a very, very good return on investment. Mm-hmm. So, don't see why we should not want to go deeper into Africa. I would love to do something in India also. And I would love to learn from the Indian plant-forward cuisine. I think that sometimes our part of the world can learn from the countries where we try to be of service. And that approach, by the way, I think is super important. If you come there and believe that you have nothing to learn, then also. So we always can learn a lot from the people we meet.
Thank you for sharing that. I want to come to the US expansion, which you shared so openly on stage in Amsterdam at the Food Summit, because you were set up to conquer the world. You went with a lot of money to one of the premium locations you can imagine. And I remember back then everybody was talking about you and this grand plan to...
I even had technical support from everything.
Yes, you had all the support that I remember back then. We met in this pizzeria in the Bronx, and I think you back then were close like 2-3 weeks before the opening, and you shared all of that. So if you can share a little bit the story ramping up to this US peak, and then not so much the fall, but the learnings of that fall. What was it at the end of the day? What went wrong, and what's your personal learning out of that story? Because that must have been a roller coaster.
I mean, there's so many learnings from that endeavor, but what led up to going to the United States at all? I mean, I had no appetite at all for going to other. But when I sold my company in 2015, or the majority of it, and suddenly I had something like 30, 40 million euros in my bank at that time. And money has never been very important to me. So it was never about growing my fortune from there. I just became very relaxed and unfocused about running a company for a little while. And then I got this strange invitation from the son of a billionaire in New York, who had this idea that he wanted to bring the soul from Noma and Wurzel to New York. And he wanted basically me to do that with him, for him. And that's how it all started. And then my three daughters and my wife, they loved the idea of us going to a new country together. They were in love with New York City. I like to be somebody who brings an adventure to his family. So I did it. I wouldn't say that I only did it for them, but their joy of us trying this out as a family was definitely a driving incentive. I mean, there was still a big purpose, you know, going to the York, still some coffee and some bread. Of course, I wanted my bread to be better than the bread that you would have, but compared to Melting Pot and Norman, transformative ideas. I mean, I guess you understand the concept of blue ocean, right?
Yes.
So I'm not a typical operator who is, you know, focused on, you know, squeezing out the last penny of each transaction. That is not my struggle. I'm a visionary.
That's the other guy, Klaus. That's the guy they hired back then. That's
So I see when I try to understand, see my, what is the, learn from my life looking backwards. I see that, I realize that I always succeed in the most utopian situations, where I failed at the most obvious ones. So as there was an evident purpose, it was truly about understanding the average guy in Grand Central Terminal, and getting the rim right and salary costs and marketing, stuff that I was not very preoccupied with.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I didn't prepare myself for it, but I simply wasn't up to the challenge. And also, and just, I think it's fair to say that I was a little bit unlucky with my choice of partner, and or my due diligence was too superficial. At the end, I don't want to give other people the responsibility for the lack of success. At the end of the day, I have only myself to thank for it. But I mean, the short answer is that I should never have wasted 3 years of my life in that city.
So you value the lost energy and time above the money you lost, Klaus?
Yeah, definitely. Because I mean, if I have 35 million euros, I will never be able to use the last 25 million of them in any meaningful way. Not that I think it's funny to waste so much money in such a short time, especially when we need to plan for it. But the feeling of being a failure and the fight to get out of that depressive state of mind that I entered into when coming back to Denmark was to me a much more serious thing than the loss of my marginal wealth.
Mm-hmm. And how you got out there, because that's the typical moment of this from doubt to drive journey. You failed, you publicly failed, you failed in New York City, not like on some secondary city. You failed in Grand Central Hall, you had a name, you failed loud. How did you recover? What's the learnings on getting out there? Like if people listen who are in dark situation, how did you get out there?
So at some point in time when I was back in Denmark, well, it starts with just accepting that you can't win this battle. It took me way too long to accept that I was beyond the points of no return. So I was wasting energy, wasting time, wasting money, trying to fix what could not be fixed. And I think that is none of my reasons. It's not super important for me to be the big winner of everything, but I hate to lose. I don't like to lose.
Mm-hmm.
I was fighting too long to not feel the shame of walking out of that situation as a fucking loser. So that's just a system error in my mental makeup. But also sometimes, sometimes I take pride in being a fighter that can turn around stuff.
Sure, but
then here, the mountain to climb was too steep, and I should have realized that half a year before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the second thing is that it's about how you perceive it. When I looked in the mirror, the first 4 or 5 months back in Denmark, I saw a loser in the mirror, and I somehow had a right that I was incompetent.
Mm.
But I thought that was the man that everyone else was looking at. So when I went to work or just walking around in the street, I didn't like to look at other people. I basically didn't like to connect with people because I felt so ashamed. So realizing that to overcome that feeling is crucial. Then the question, of course, is how do you then do that? For me, it was a couple of things. One was that I, at some point, I gave up on the idea that I should find rationally through a thought process a tactical way out of this. I it was only when I gave up on the idea to intellectually produce a way out, and when I just went out and just did small jobs or tried to be helpful in my company, that somehow lost found me. So it was when accepting to do work hunt, not trying to be the big picture guy. That somehow I started feeling hopeful and resourceful again. Listening to gospel music helped me a lot. There were certain lyrics that really moved me. I mean, not that I was super, you know, a big believer in God or anything, but just someone and the voice telling me again and again that this is just God lifting you. This one is not on you. It's not your fault. To feel the forgiveness from the universe or from the Father, whoever he is. And that unconditional devotion and trust and love from someone outside of my own family. My own family couldn't provide this relief. But somehow listening to gospel music gave me a feeling of being universally loved beforehand, no matter if I did one or two or four wrong things in my life, I was loved. So that feeling of being universally loved truly helped me get back up on my feet. And then at some point in time, I learned to see things and feel grateful. Maybe for you guys, it's obvious, but at least I have arrived at a point in my life where no matter what I looked at, I didn't feel gratitude. I just felt nothing or shame. So when I started just expressing gratitude to other people or feeling gratitude for the sun, that the sun was shining, or when I looked at my wife one morning in the bed, she'd been lying there with me for the previous 25 years, giving me three children. But then suddenly one day, and I just looked at her and said, wow, how magical isn't this? Who am I to deserve this beautiful woman has been choosing me over anyone else for all these years? And then the last couple of things I mentioned kind of reinforced each other and became like a wave of change of mindset and mood and attitude. Yeah. And then suddenly, you know, during maybe a month, I came from the darkness into the light, and I was a new version of myself, not necessarily a better version, but and maybe a more nuanced version, a more reflected someone. Yes, then that is probably the best way I can explain how I got back. I mean, of course, I was asked to write on the purpose statement company, the company that I founded and sold in 2015, and the process of getting together with the loyal co-workers and ask ourselves what is the essence of this company, and they really working hard to define a beautiful ultimate purpose of why we go to work every morning. And to phrase that in a way that defines a pathway for development and evolution for the company and for ourselves. And where it's no longer a matter of did you fail or succeed on this or that, but it's a matter of a long journey where you always are faithful to why you are doing this job. That bigger picture, that long light also helped me forget about my past pathetic performance.
I think, Klaus, I already heard this speech in Amsterdam, but now hearing you talking, first of all, I want to thank you for sharing on behalf of all the struggling entrepreneurs out there, because we all have been there, maybe not as dark as the ones you describe, but it always is very subjective what dark is. And it's so difficult in that phase, as you shared, to have any kind of getting grit on falling down. And I think I can just encourage you to keep on sharing that story in whatever form you manage to do that, as a book, as a workshop, as whatever, because this will help so many people out there. I don't know what is the new nuanced, you called him nuanced, you call him better, Klaus Meyer is doing, but the manifesto on the new entrepreneur, or whatever you want to call it, I think there is something in there, because we all don't have to be the perfect leaders and entrepreneurs out there. We are allowed to struggle and be and fail and stand up again and be nuanced. And I think a lot of the pressure we have on us is that we think we're not allowed to fail, and that creates so much shame. I think that was the word you used most often in the interview so far, is the shame, that only comes from the belief, I guess, we all had and have, that we're not allowed to fail. But that that was a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that, Florian.
We are unfortunately at the end of our conversation already. I could just go on and listen and ask more questions, but our time is over. So Klaus, thank you so much for sharing all these insights and stories and doubts. And as we learned from you and also from others, you can always go from the dark into the light. And this is, I think, what you showed us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for sharing.
There's always hope.
Hola, hola, what a benchmark. I think if there's a guy from doubt to thrive and who is able and willing to share, then it's Klaus. No?
Crazy.
I
mean,
incredible.
Amazing. I'm still flashed, and I think we can be very grateful that he took the time to talk to us and shared his journey. So let's dive into it quickly.
Yes.
My first note right from the beginning, when he said there's a correlation between love and deliciousness.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think what I also like, he could be the proudest ever to create Noma. But he said it was just an instrument and an icon, because he wants to have this access of food for everyone, because he got into this French life. He shared that he was there on this journey, and this everyday happiness, he called it, people together celebrating, that's kind of motivating him, and not so much about how often he wins as a best restaurateur. He said, we have forgotten on how to eat, and with the Nordic Manifesto, I think he must have been one of the earliest to combine that sustainability movement with food.
And then there comes already the first notion of his philanthropic approach, where he said eating right can help the planet.
Eating right can help the planet. He also talks about the power of cooking. And he said back then with the manifesto, he said we had no mandate, no budget, no resources, and we worked on an open and source and this power of cooking and Noma. I mean, what he started there, I mean, at the end of the day, Noma won 5 cent best restaurant, and there's now 150 Michelin star restaurants because of this power of the Nordic manifesto.
Yeah, and in that context, he also said when life becomes detached from cooking, you lose meaning, purpose, and togetherness. Very nice.
Only two things matter, love and food. Einstein.
Now we go to the big crisis.
Yeah, first crisis, two crisis, first crisis.
Early crisis, no? When he said, I always doubt about everything. If I lose this one, at least I took a chance. So there's already the possibility of losing and winning combined.
I think there was two things. It's incredible how open he talked about this relationship with the father, because he said his father basically always made him believe he's not enough, and that's why he's it's easier for him to handle critiques, because he expected that. But then when they hired this Auntie Klaus, as he called him, the CEO of his company, At the end of the day, and I think that's the learning, he would have never made money with that entity, but he built it, yeah? And this other guy, the Anti-Klaus, as we call him, really made a cash cow out of it and also enabled him actually to sell his shares out of this crisis to being fired from your own company, which we hear a lot of times. The fortune was born. So
yeah, but that is also nice when he then went further and talked about the Melting Pot Foundation.
Oh,
and
he got passionate with
yeah,
that.
Absolutely. That there he said they pay me with gratitude and love, and they just want to
was love,
and they just want to give. That's really nice.
And he said, although we brought everything, money and time, he felt so remunerated. He said. And then he said, and I like that one, because we talked a lot of times here on this podcast about the blue ocean. But he was the first who really took it in his mouth and said, I'm the blue ocean guy. And then he said, I succeed in utopian setups and I fail in the most obvious one. And I think that's really something to point out. I think disruptors like he's and visionaries, when you look at them and when they stumble and fail, you say, like, how can such a big guy fail with this or that? But it's because of the different wiring. He's a blue ocean guy. He maybe fails in the most obvious one, but he's also the one succeeding and building an amazing restaurant in Bolivia and one in Brownsville where you cannot even walk in without the security. So the impossible, the blue oceans, he succeeds and thrives, and the possible ones, and that was the big story at the end in New York, where you say, how can you fail at the best location in New York? Great Central Station, a
funding,
lot of money,
everything.
The track record of Noma, all in. And I remember back then, and I literally had it's 2 weeks before the opening. And I thought, like this guy can never fail. Like, is everything there? And boom.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
He had the failure.
So how he went out of this crisis and this moment of doubt was that you have to accept that you can't win the battle. And at the same time, he made clear how much he, as a person, actually hates to lose. And to overcome these personal roadblocks, so this frustration, it was really amazing how he got back on his feet and said, okay, the money is wasted, but even more, my time of my lifetime,
and the
3 years are
wasted. Yes, and the face value, because he said, I looked into the mirror and I saw a loser, and I thought that everyone else sees the same. I think that was a very strong And he said, because he's like, you heard it in the call, he's a very philosophical guy. And he said, I try to solve the crisis intellectually. I tried to find an intellectual way out. And only when I gave up to find that intellectual way, love found me.
Yeah, that was amazing. And then at the end, what helped him was where he said gospel music or a voice that told him that it was not only his fault, and
not
he felt this
fault.
Forgiveness of the universe, he said. And I think this is something where that is the light at the end of the tunnel, and if you believe in that, whatever it is, it obviously can help you getting back on track.
And he shared, which was also an exercise which was shared two times here, like the being grateful exercise, finding the small things, although you're in the deepest, darkest place to see, okay, I'm grateful for something. And he said, out of this crisis, there was a new version, a nuanced version of himself created. Not a better one, he said, but a nuanced one. So incredible. And I think, and I hope we're going to hear more from Klaus. What an incredible guy. Yeah. I was lucky enough to hear him two times, talking one time in Zurich, in Amsterdam, and in this fantastic pizza place with Rico and Philip, and now here with you, Florian. What a guy.
Yeah, that's it for today.
That's it. Oh, take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
Wow. We hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as we did. But sharing is not just caring. It is also empowering. So recommend this podcast to fellow entrepreneurs who might need a dose of inspiration. And don't forget to hit the subscribe button so you'll never miss out on future episodes. Thank you for being part of the community from Doubt to Drive Entrepreneurs Only. Mario and Florian are already gearing up for the next episode. Until then, stay tuned, stay driven, and we'll be back next week.